Good evening, I'm Patrick Stewart, thespian, here to guide you through tonight's entertainment. You might remember me from such memorable roles as IRA terrorist with thinning hair in Hennessy, or asylum director possessed by nude-space vampire girl in Life Force. For now, dear listener, I'm your humble host, introducing you to this latest episode in the adventures of Doc Sleaze. Listen on, friend.
I think it's time that the entertainment world fully embraced AI and just handed over creative activity to the computers. No, really, just hear me out on this. We really would be better off if we just let AI write all of our books, film, TV scripts, and replace all of our flesh and blood actors with AI avatars. Once you've done that, then you might as well just hand over the direction, editing, etc., films and TV to AI as well. Okay, I know what your objections are going to be, that the end result of this would be to render the creative industries entirely derivative, turning out bland identikit projects barely distinguishable from each other. But let's face it, most books, films and TV are already like that, despite apparently being created by humans. So would you really be able to tell the difference? But what are the benefits of removing the human factor, I hear you ask? Well, I'll tell you, it will save us from disappointment. I mean, how many times have you really enjoyed the work of a particular author? Really invested in their writing, recommended it to friends and family, extolled its virtues on social media, only to have the rug pulled out from under you when it's revealed they're actually some kind of raving sex offender? Not only do you have to burn all of their books that you have in your collection, but you have to go on social media and totally cancel them, eating your own words of praise as you do it. Plus, your judgment will be forever called into question by your family once it becomes clear that you've been recommending books written by a gross pervert to your 13-year-old niece. You only have to look at the fallout from those recent allegations of sexual impropriety made against Neil Gaiman. The trauma it's causing former fans is terrible to behold, as they rush to denounce him and cover themselves by claiming that they always thought there was something dodgy about him, threatening to crush each other in the cancellation stampede. I feel that I should point out here that as I record this, these are still just allegations against Gaiman. He hasn't been charged with anything, so I add the usual reminder that under our system of justice, people are innocent until proven guilty. And personally, I'm not a fan. I have no idea whether any of the allegations are true, but I do feel in an awkward position as I've given his books and graphic novels to my teenage great-nieces as birthday and Christmas presents in the past. So, you know. Imagine, though, if all of his body of work had instead been written by an AI called Neil Gaiman, a disembodied collection of algorithms incapable of any kind of sexual misconduct. There'd be no risk of fans having to go through this sort of trauma, would there? That's the beauty of AI. It might lack any spark of originality, but it also isn't going to embarrass you by turning out to be a rapist, racist, misogynist, or anti-Semite. And if it did develop any such tendencies, then a swift tweak of the algorithm would sort it out. The same applies to performers. Imagine if Russell Brand had been created by AI. Just imagine how much safer women would feel. If Klaus Kinski had been an AI creation, then countless actresses and other women would have been spared sexual molestation on Italian film sets. Sure, he could have been programmed to be a sex offender by some twisted tech type, but only have been able to molest AI women, not real ones. And I'm guessing this is the main attraction of AI actors for studio chiefs and producers. No risk of having your box office ruined when your star goes psycho and starts assaulting people. No expensive reshoots to replace the star accused of shagging horses. And no shelving of complete films when it comes to light that your leading man is prime suspect in a series of cannibalistic murders, say. Likewise, AI directors won't be blowing budgets on vanity projects or sulking after their film is recut by the producers. But just as with writers, the main benefits of AI actors will be felt by fans, who will never again have to worry that their hero is going to be revealed as a drunken wife beater or a drug-addled Nazi sympathiser. Parents could rest easy that the idols whose posters their darling daughters pin up on their bedroom walls won't turn out to be predatory paedophiles, flashers, or simply all-round sleazeballs. So come on, embrace the AI revolution. It'll improve your mental health no end as you find that you no longer have to invest so much time and energy into cancelling that person you formerly idolised.
Sistemas han fallado.
¿Qué puede pasar?
Nada. La bomba caerá al mar. Una gran explosión nuclear la despertó de su largo reposo en las profundidades del océano. Sus efectos la enloquecieron transformándola en una bestia asesina.
¡Mirad eso!
Y la leyenda se hizo realidad.
¡Rápido, de mar, vamos!
Serpiente de mar. Serpiente de mar. Su nombre se convirtió en sinónimo de muerte y destrucción para los hombres y embarcaciones que se cruzaban en su camino.
¿No has oído?
Se acerca una lancha como si hubiera sin luz. Imbéciles. No sé a dónde pueden ir esos desgraciados.
¿Pero qué es esto?
¿Qué es eso? ¿No has oído?
Una superproducción llevada al cine por José Frade y dirigida por Amando de Osorio. Serpiente de mar. Con Timothy Bottoms, Tarim Power, Jared Martin y Ryan Milan.
Lo destruirá todo.
Serpiente de mar. La leyenda se hizo realidad.
Amando de Osorio's last film, although he's credited as Gregory Greene's for his direction and Gordon A. Osborne as a writer on the English language version of this film, The Sea Serpent from 1985 would be a poor epitaph for anyone's career, let alone for a director held in high regard for his Blind Dead series. In truth, though, aside from the four Blind Dead movies, most of de Osorio's work is fairly routine, rarely recapturing the musty menace and doom-laden atmosphere of these films. And in truth, The Sea Serpent is just a 50s giant monster movie, replicating all of the flaws of the genre and offering no improvements in technical terms other than the addition of colour. It opens poorly, with a US warplane represented via stock footage being forced to jettison a nuclear weapon in the Atlantic, setting it to detonate on the ocean bed in order to stop the Soviets from getting their hands on it. The whole thing is ineptly filmed, with the budget apparently not even running to US military uniforms. The guys back in the mission control room are all dressed in scruffy-looking civilian clothes. Of course, the explosion inevitably awakens a prehistoric sea serpent, which proceeds to rampage its way through Spanish waters. I say rampage, but rather ludicrously, its attacks are always so small scale that virtually nobody sees the bloody thing, with the only survivors of its attacks not being believed. It sinks a trawler early on, eating some of the crew, but only the captain sees it, and he's accused of causing the sinking himself through being drunk on watch, losing his captain's certificate at the subsequent inquiry. Which calls into question Spanish maritime investigation techniques. They never seem to question how the captain's alleged drunkenness could possibly result in the boat's hull being breached below the waterline when in deep waters. Such damage could surely only be caused by a moving submerged object. Hey, what do I know? In its next attack, the creature eats a tourist who has foolishly gone to sea and a dinghy after a night in a casino. Only her friend on shore sees what happens, despite the beach being only yards from a crowded casino. Obviously nobody believes her, and she finds herself locked up in a psychiatric unit. So it goes on. The serpent destroys a lighthouse, but there are no witnesses except the keeper, who is killed. It attacks a boat full of cigarette smugglers, the only survivor being left semi-comatose and barely coherent. In an incredibly contrived plot twist, this survivor is silenced permanently by the smuggling gang, fearful that he'll tell the authorities about their operation. Naturally, the disgraced captain springs the American woman tourist from the hospital, and they try to find a way of proving the beast's existence, roping in a sceptical and ill marine biologist. By an amazing stroke of luck, the captain's former first mate, who had held him responsible not just for the sinking of the trawler, but also the death of his brother in an earlier accident, finally sees the monster himself. When it attacks a wharf, again, it conveniently leaves no other witnesses, joining the other three for a climactic sea serpent hunt. Now, the poor script, with its appallingly clunky dialogue, weak characterizations, plot convolutions that go to ridiculous lengths to ensure that while it serves up a number of monster attacks, the authorities never seem to be aware of the creature's existence. None of this would have mattered so much if the film gave us a decent monster, but sadly it doesn't. Indeed, its special effects look several notches below those employed in the 50s monster movies that it is clearly trying to emulate. The sea serpent itself is, in the main, represented by what is basically a sock puppet, or at least its head and neck are, every time it surfaces. A larger model is used for when it has a victim in its jaws, but this is no more effective. While swimming in water, the model used looks like a child's toy. Regardless of how it is being represented, it is a pretty lousy-looking sea serpent, with bulging ping-pong ball eyes and stick-on fins. In truth, all of the film's effects and miniature works are of a very poor quality. Particularly bad is the scene at the film's climax, when the serpent attacks a railway bridge, coiling around the supports just as a steam-hauled train passes over it, despite the fact that mainline steam haulage in Spain ended in the mid-70s. But what the hell? The miniature train itself is so crude that it barely qualifies as a model, looking more like a toy, an impression reinforced by the thin stream of pale smoke wisping from its chimney. And this is most likely created using a Sooth smoke unit, a crude device used by Trying in the 60s on some of its model locos. It was basically an electrically heated metal plate onto which was poured oil, which in turn burned off to produce foul-smelling and unconvincing smoke. If you're really unlucky, you could warp and melt the plastic locomotive body, but hey, again, I digress. Not surprisingly, in an attempt to disguise the poor quality of the effects, all of the monster's attacks occur at night. On top of that, the film's photography overall is dark and murky, although this could simply be down to the fact that the version I saw was an old VHS transfer. In its favour, the film actually musters a pretty impressive-looking cast, including Timothy Bottoms, Jared Martin and Taron Power. All are defeated, however, by the script, which simply doesn't give them a chance to do anything other than go through the motions. The biggest name, though, is an extremely ill-looking Ray Milland, and this was to be his last feature film appearance, who stumbles, mumbles and growls his way through the role of the marine biologist. Even though I'm usually a sucker for monster movies, I found The Sea Serpent pretty hard going. I'd had hoped, on the basis that D'Osorio was director, that it might not be as bad as its reputation and might have some redeeming features. Sadly, though, it comes over as a barely competent, staggering through its 90 minutes or so of running time to a decidedly anticlimactic climax with the monster getting away. The producers were clearly hoping for a sequel. There's nothing distinguished in the direction, giving the impression that, to D'Osorio, it was just another low-budget assignment to be knocked out as cheaply and quickly as possible. A sad footnote to his career.
You might think it's strange that a Shakespearean actor like myself has enjoyed so much Hollywood success, but the fact is that our stage training means that we Brits can deliver the heavy-duty swear words in films far better than American actors. Allow me to demonstrate wonk, bollocks, shit, cocksucker, prick, motherfucker and tits. Now, from the mouth of a De Niro or Pacino, mere obscenities, but from the mouth of a classically trained actor, purest poetry.
Is it just me, or have TV commercials really crossed a line in terms of good taste when it comes to certain products? Things like toilet paper, for instance. We all know what it is for. Do we really need ads involving people actually sitting on the crapper? Okay. I know that they've been heading this way for many years now, but it just feels as if they're getting worse. It isn't just toilet paper, it's bodily functions generally. I mean, a while ago, I had the TV on in the background when suddenly I got someone in my living room bellowing out, "Stubborn stool," before going on to try and sell me a stool softening product in between shots of sufferers straining faces as they try to painfully pass a particularly recalcitrant turd. I was eating, for God's sake! But worse than interrupting my meal with thoughts of chronic constipation, the ad was screening in the middle of an episode of The Love Boat. I mean, and Pluto has a channel that shows on a loop. It's one of my go-to places for passive, inoffensive background TV viewing. Anyway, The Love Boat, a TV show from the golden era of 70s and 80s US TV, where nobody had a toilet. Not in their workplace, not in their home, certainly not public ones on the street. Trust me, that entire ship in The Love Boat doesn't have a single toilet lurking anywhere amongst its hundreds of cabins. Leaving the question of where people actually went to back then. I mean, you know, maybe in The Love Boat, they just crapped over the side. Perhaps that's why Starsky and Hutch and the Dukes of Hazzard spent so much time roaring around at high speed in their cars. They were desperately seeking a secluded place to take a dump. I know that there's long been a theory that in Star Trek, Kirk, Spock et al. Just used to beam down to random planets they're passing to relieve themselves, doubtless causing all manner of diplomatic incidents with Klingons. The alternative, of course, is that back then, people on US TV simply didn't have normal bodily functions. After all, not only do they not have toilets and apparently never take a dump or a piss, they never seem to fart either. Ever seen Captain Stubing on The Love Boat suddenly excuse himself from a conference on the bridge, stick his arse out of the door on the port side, let rip in the direction of the bridge wing, whilst sounding the ship's horn to cover up? By contrast, on UK TV in the 70s and 80s, toilets were very much in evidence. After all, we have a whole system of humour based around bodily functions, which we find hilarious, but toilets, for some reason, are also considered hilarious in their own right by us Brits, especially when they aren't being used for their correct purpose. Characters flushing unlikely objects intentionally or by accident down toilet bowls is a staple for 70s sitcoms. Blocking a toilet in this way, causing it to overflow, flooding the house, was always a sure way of guaranteeing big belly laughs. Even better was when somebody stuck their foot, or even better, their head down a toilet. I mean, there was a whole episode of Some Mothers Do Have 'Em devoted to Frank Spencer, played by Michael Crawford, suffering such mishaps with his brother-in-law's toilet. Similarly, I recall there was a whole episode of On the Buses devoted to Stan's attempts to install a new toilet in his mother's house, and another, if I remember rightly, involving goldfish getting flushed down the pan. This obsession with the comic potential of toilets wasn't just confined to British TV. I mean, the Carry On series had an entire movie, Carry On at Your Convenience, devoted to the subject, for instance, while the rest of the series was permeated with toilet humour. Even pop stars recognised the comic value of the toilet. Why else do you think that Keith Moon kept blowing them up in hotel rooms? Now, you'd think that having grown up immersed in toilet humour, TV ads like the Stubborn Stool one wouldn't bother me at all. But that's the point, that this humour quite literally focused on the toilet itself, not the functions it was meant to serve. Sure, we have plenty of fart jokes and gags about people pissing or shitting themselves in embarrassing situations, but they were never explicit as to the mechanics, so to speak, of the functions involved. The sort of TV ads I see now take us to a level of specific detail we really don't need to know. Far too much information, as they say. Or even fart too much information. Besides, when it comes to those stubborn stools, the answer is to drink more water. Really, it is, more often than not, down to a lack of proper hydration. Believe me, having been forced to drink large volumes of water for the sake of my kidneys the past few years, I can honestly say that isn't a problem I have the misfortune to experience anymore.
Ah, the Love Boat. I recall the episode where I stood in for Gavin McLeod as Captain Estubing. Poor Gavin had a bad case of the punicare ruts and didn't dare get off the toilet for 3 days. I seem to remember that Isaac had to perform some unspeakable sex act with guest star Broderick Crawford after losing a bet. But Doc had run out of lubricant. So Persa Smith suggested using the butter he had mistakenly overordered instead. In a fit of inspiration, I ad-libbed make it so, Gopher. Make it so. Pure genius.
There's been much furore lately over the announcement that Facebook was to end third-party fact-checking as part of Zuckerberg's attempts to cozy up to Trump. Apparently, third-party moderation is too open to political bias, whereas the community fact-checking system they're proposing as a replacement isn't. A theory which flies in the face of established facts on the subject, but there you go. The irony of this sort of reaction from the UK's media is that increasingly most of their reporting is barely fact-based. Okay, in many cases, it is entirely fact-free. Most of the reporting seems to be based upon a journalist's access to confidential sources, who must always remain anonymous, the implication being that these sources are somehow connected insiders, be it in politics, business or whatever, who have access to actual information. Personally, I find them of highly dubious quality. Indeed, I wonder if they exist at all, or are they, like those in-the-know sources endlessly referenced by football websites who supposedly have the inside track on player transfers and managerial sackings and appointments, but are invariably wrong and usually turn out to be the assistant groundsman's sister's boyfriend's second cousin's hairdresser who once cut the boot boy's hair? I mean, bearing in mind that both the police and security services in the UK seem to want to rely upon the public for intelligence gathering, forever urging us to ring confidential phone lines to report on any suspicious foreign-looking types we see buying the New Statesman or the Guardian, are the media now following the same model? Could it be that the likes of the Daily Mail and Express are down to using nosy neighbours as sources? And let's face it, the Sun has been doing it for decades, while the Daily Star hasn't run a story that wasn't complete fiction since, well, the day it first rolled off the presses. After all, though, for stories about horrendous crimes, who could be a better source for speculation about the victims and suspected perpetrators than that bloke from down the street who spends his days peering at houses through binoculars, logging his neighbour's every movement? Oh yes, I have it on record here that I definitely saw Mr. Smith from number 9 regularly going in through the back door of number 16 to have sex with Mrs. Jones in her living room. They never drew the curtains in the weeks leading up to her murder. Even better, nowadays we have those voyeurs who set up cameras all over their properties, not to protect them against burglars, but to spy on the neighbours. They have footage that could rival any surveillance operation by MI5. Then there are those bloody doorbell cameras which are becoming ever more prevalent, again ostensibly so that you can see who's knocking on your door without opening it or when you aren't at home, but in reality capturing footage of every passerby. Now you might say, this is all very well as a source for information on news stories that involve ordinary people in ordinary neighbourhoods, but how could it ever be an effective replacement for high-level sources on stories involving the great and the good? Well, what if that nosy neighbour had been adamant that it wasn't Mr. Smith going into Mrs. Jones' back door before she's murdered, but Liberal Party leader Ed Davey, say, or Prince Andrew, a more likely candidate, I'd think. Not good enough for an arrest, perhaps, although with the current state of the UK police, you never know. But certainly good enough for the press to smear the allegation across their front pages. What if he reckoned that it wasn't Mr. Brown from number 40's dog shitting on number 22's lord, but the Archbishop of Canterbury, presumably taking up time off from covering up sex abuse cases? Again, I strongly suspect that it might make the front pages too. You can also guarantee that if they get their observations into the papers, even anonymously for the smaller stuff, before you know it, these nosy neighbours will get a taste for it and start expanding their operations. They'll start hanging around parks where politicians take their afternoon strolls in the hope of overhearing a confidential conversation on a sensitive subject, or standing on milk crates to peer through the windows of motels where some minor league celebrity or someone who looks a bit like them has gone for an illicit assignation. For all we know, some of those supposed high-level political sources are actually simply the nosy neighbours of the politicians involved, busy listening at connecting walls with upturned glasses or watching them on their security and doorbell cameras. Who needs facts and journalism when you can have much more interesting rumours instead, eh?
Ram-chee-da-ram on the prairie, ha! Shamu-rabbit-cheetah is here. You feel his breath on your back. Your heart is breaking his claws and legs. Fly, eagle, dart on the sky. Shamu-rabbit, the eagle is here.
Vi ricordo che i soggetti che vi presentiamo sono stati particolarmente e preventivamente selezionati. Sono ragazze sane, incensurate e disposte a qualsiasi esperienza. Quella che presentiamo ora è una ragazza origine franco-canadese, graziosa, tipo romantico. O Elizabeth, psicologicamente disposta a qualsiasi esperienza e soprattutto vergine.
The night is coming, cold on the land. Only the jackal plays on the sand.
Dopotutto, se si vuole scrivere qualcosa di buono, bisogna pure rischiare. Il campo della prostituzione interessa un sacco di gente. In quel giro ci sono ragazzine giovanissime.
Emmanuel and the White Slave Trade from 1978 was the last of the Italian-made Black Emmanuel series to be directed by Joe D'Amato, who directed the bulk of the series. In truth, beyond the similar name for the lead character, but if you note, there's a slight difference in spelling, in that the Italian Black Emmanuel has only one M in her name, whereas the French original series had two M's. These films have little in common with the original Emmanuel series, which involved the erotic exploits of a French diplomat's wife. By contrast, this rival series concerned the adventures of an investigative journalist played by Laura Gemser, who has the byline of Emmanuel for her articles. Over the course of the series, she investigates all manner of subject matter, including snuff films and cannibals, with the globe-trotting investigations always involving her having to take her clothes off and have sex with men, women, herself, or even a horse gets a hand job in one installment, although not by Emmanuel herself, to be fair. Anyway, the films tend to involve somewhat meandering plots, with Emmanuel spending the first part investigating one thing, gangsters, for example, which inadvertently lead her into investigating something more serious and or exotic. Emmanuel in the White Slave Trade kicks off in Kenya, with the titular heroine trying to get an interview with an expat US gangster, which involves her and a female friend pretending to be air hostesses, running naked through the bush and having drug-fueled sex, not to mention various other sexual asides not directly related to the main plot. In the course of all this, she spots a suspicious character at the airport escorting a girl in a wheelchair who later turns out to be perfectly healthy, with the gangster telling her that the man is involved in trafficking girls for the white slave trade. Naturally, Emmanuel decides to follow him, which leads her back to the US at a brothel, which she infiltrates, catering to high-level politicians and diplomats. at which point the film, as is often the case with the series, takes a somewhat darker turn than you'd ever see in a genuine Emmanuel film, or any of their many imitators, involving murder and Emmanuel herself being roughed up and sexually assaulted by a gang of heavies working for the madam running the brothel. Now, this section of the film is actually an attempt to cash in on another then-popular sex movie, 1977's The French Woman, which had been directed by Jess Jakin, who had also directed the first Emmanuel movie, and was his later film was inspired by the life story of an infamous French brothel keeper, Madame Claude. Indeed, Emmanuel and the White Slave Trade even names the keeper of its brothel Madame Claude, just to make sure that the link is clear to the audience. Now, the latter part of the film underlines the fundamental difference between the Black Emmanuel series and both the original series, whose name it invokes, and that series' many other imitators. They eschew the semi-respectable artiness of those films in favour of a much harder-edged and grittier approach. This Emmanuel has no time for wistful explorations of feminine sensuality, more often than not treating her sexuality as simply another tool to be used in a quest for the truth via her investigations. As played by Gemser, she is no ingenue or innocent schoolgirl experiencing a sexual awakening at the hands of some experienced older man. On the contrary, she is a capable career woman, more than able to look after herself. Unlike most of the heroines of contemporary sex movies, when in peril, she doesn't wait for some man to rescue her, instead falling back on her own resources to get out of the situation. All of which makes it sound as if I'm trying to argue that Gemser's Emmanuel is some kind of symbol of female empowerment, a porno feminist icon. Make no mistake, however, the film still objectifies her as a sex object, but at least the character has some control over this objectification, using it to her own advantage. The look of the film reflects the grittier edge of the series, with the dreamy soft-focus photography and leisurely pace of the official series discarded in favour of a more realistic, hard-edged approach, far more like contemporary Italian crime thrillers. The subject matter of many of the D'Amato films and its lurid presentation is reminiscent of another Italian genre, the Mondo movie. D'Amato directed films across a wide gamut of popular Italian movie genres, and this is reflected in the subject matter of his Black Emmanuel films. While not perhaps possessed of a visual style on a par with many of his contemporaries directing Italian genre films, D'Amato's direction is nonetheless efficient and very direct, making Emmanuel in the White Slave Trade, and indeed the other films in the series that he directed, a very easy film for the audience to follow. There's always something going on to hold your attention, even when Emmanuel is fully clothed. Gemser, as ever, is very watchable in the lead role, bringing plenty of charisma and screen presence, and as ever, her real-life husband, Gabriel Tinti, co-stars, this time as the brothel's procurer. While not the strongest, almost original entry in the series, prostitution of various kinds has been covered several times in earlier films, Emmanuel and the White Slave Trade is an entertaining enough piece of exploitation, and in my opinion far more enjoyable than most other Emmanuel cash-ins being made around the time at the same time, which slavishly tried to copy the original's format and style.
My good friend Peter O'Toole once told me about his trip to see a 3D pornographic film. He said it was a most harrowing experience, with penises constantly thrusting out of the screen and into his face. Apparently, he left the cinema feeling more than a little cock-eyed.
You know, when I was at school, there are always those kids who like to talk big, to advertise their non-conformism at every turn, be it by wearing their shirt with the top button undone and their tie loose so as to demonstrate the fact that by wearing or to demonstrate the fact that they didn't conform to school rules, or by wearing non-regulation shoes. Sometimes they might even hand their homework in late or fake a sick note. But when push came to shove and they found themselves confronted by authority, they always folded without a fight. You always knew they could never be relied upon to stand up to bullying teachers or challenge unfair and arbitrary school rules when push came to shove. That was left to idiots like me, the unfashionable kids who weren't part of a clique, who didn't play sports, weren't academically brilliant enough to apply to Oxford or Cambridge, and therefore couldn't add to the school's prestige. But we were deluded enough to believe that principles mattered and you should stand up for them, even if all it got you was a detention and the derision of those self-styled cool kids who never conformed, except when they thought there might be consequences to their nonconformity, then they knuckled under. As an adult, I found the same pattern of behaviour in the workplace. Lots of these self-styled rebels were always quick to complain about management and working conditions. When it came to face-to-face confrontations with the bosses or calling in the union, they were suddenly silent. They were nowhere to be found. Again, it was idiots like me who had to do that, with no support from those bastards. I learned an important lesson from these experiences, mainly that doing the right thing, sticking to your principles and trying to make sure that people are treated fairly will never make you popular. On the contrary, it will get you labelled awkward and a troublemaker, which in turn will ensure that your progress career-wise is very slow regardless of how well you do your job. But why should we have expected those cool kids ever to behave differently? For them, nonconformism and rebellion are all just an act. They do it because it's fashionable, not because they actually believe in any of it. Scratch the surface of any one of them, and you'd find that in reality, they are incredibly conventional in their outlooks and thinking, the products usually of comfortably off middle-class families. They only rebelled as long as they felt safe doing it. As soon as it threatened consequences, they were out of there. They were always going to acquiesce to authority because they themselves were from the same milieu as those in authority. Their parents usually held positions of minor authority, assistant bank managers, teachers, librarians, businessmen, etc. They always had excuses, of course, usually that it wasn't the right time to stand up and be counted, although they never seemed to be able to pinpoint a right time to put their nonconformity into action. Anyway, for the same reasons, we really shouldn't be disappointed in all those people and organisations who threw their hats in the ring in opposition to Trump in the 2024 presidential election campaign, who are now that he's won, lining up to prostrate themselves before him. They've got too much to potentially lose by continuing their opposition to him, which is why billionaires like Bezos and Zuckerberg are busy kissing his ass. You know, they spent all this time trying to convince us they were different. Hey, we have consciences, etc. We believe in principles. But yeah. But hey, surely we never expected anything else of the mega rich, though, did we? They failed to buy the election their way, because that's what the whole business of removing Biden for the Democratic nomination was all about. Wealthy people trying to influence the vote by substituting their candidate for someone perceived as a failing candidate. So it's only natural that they change horses again. Money loves to be associated with a winner, after all. Which is why, even before the votes were in, they were hedging their bets with Bezos stopping his newspaper from endorsing Harris, for instance. When news outlets start acquiescing, then it's time to be worried and disappointed. ABC, they caved into Trump's threatened libel case and paid him $15 million. Despite the fact it was a perfectly defensible case, while the owner of the Los Angeles Times has happily vetoed his paper from printing editorials critical of Trump. Again, it's all about them and their wealthy backers protecting their interests. To hell with the press having a duty to hold power to account when there's a risk that the vengeful ego in the White House might not just sue you, but start deploying all the considerable force of the state against you and your assets. Which is why revolutions are usually carried out by people with nothing to lose. Sure, they are usually inspired and led, from a distance, by middle-class intellectuals and other well-off people, but the actual blood, sweat and tears are provided by the disenfranchised, who, if they win, are more often than usual betrayed by the leaders, who never actually got their hands dirty or expose themselves to risk during the revolution itself, instead shouting the masses on from the sidelines, you know, and holding their coats for them. The trick that the establishment seems to have perfected right now is, by pretending not to be the establishment and instead populists on the side of the little man, convincing those masses with nothing to lose to support them instead of the revolution or indeed any progressive movement. Obviously they'll betray them, just as surely as the other lot will betray those who fought the revolution for them. The difference is that these days, people's attention spans become so short, they seem to quickly forget the earlier betrayal and vote for the populace all over again, hence Trump's second term in spite of what happened last time around. So what's the moral here? Under no circumstances, trust anyone who is conspicuously trendy, nonconformist and loudly radical, fond of telling everyone just how virtuous they are, for loudly opposing stuff on supposed moral grounds, regardless of which side they purport to be on. They're most likely pretentious pricks, interested only in preening their own egos, and will, when the chips are down, inevitably betray any cause they claim to support.
And now, the show draws to a close and it falls to me, your humble host, to bid you farewell. Before you go, I'd like to leave you with a final thought. In the words of Kipling, remember that in the kingdom of the deaf, the one-legged man is king. Good night.